Kind of a legal grab bag today. Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney. You love when we do a grab bag, don't you?
It's a good time, John. They ask us anything they want, and, you know, we make up answers is basically how it goes. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you're a lawyer, but as we've talked a lot about on the show, and you're a very well-esteemed one and covered civil cases, you've covered criminal cases, so you can answer a lot. But obviously, lawyers are specific to certain fields. So I guess what I'm saying is, you'll do your best.
I'll do my best, John. As will you, as you be playing a lawyer.
Yes,
you know?
Playing a lawyer. And I'll take you up till 3 o'clock when the real lawyer, the wonderful Karen Conti, comes on.
The real lawyer. Wow.
Well, not you. I mean, from a host perspective.
Do I leave now?
Yeah, no. So we got 4 hours of law ahead. So, but we can keep it fun and light, too. We got a couple calls coming in. But first, I saw that Sam Waterston is stepping down from Law & Order after 400-some episodes. Would you ever yell like that at court or no?
I don't yell at the other attorney or the judge, but you can definitely raise your voice to the witness and get away with it, and sometimes pretty loud.
Sam Waterston did so. What's his character's name again? I forgot already.
Wow.
I don't know. I just look on TV and I go, oh, I'm not like a loyal Law & Order.
Yeah.
It's more like when I'm at a hotel and just trying to kill some time. Law & Order.
It's insane how often. So if you're on a road, it's on like 24/7 on some channel. But yeah, I enjoyed the show for a lot of years. I think he was the best that early era of the show. And then I thought it got a little bit tired.
Oh, really?
I thought so. But, you know, every one of those shows kind of runs its course. But
I mean, he's been Jack McCoy. He's been playing that character since the mid-90s. So it begged the question, is he the best TV or movie lawyer of all time? 312-91-7200. 262 says Perry Mason, of course.
Of course. That's the most classic. So right. you got to go with that.
Favorite TV lawyer from the 630, Alan Shore from Boston Legal.
Loved Boston Legal. Yeah, that was a good one, too.
That's pretty good. So 312-981-7200. Add yours to the list.
I don't think we usually get the younger listeners, but Suits is doing this revival because Netflix brought it back. So I wonder if we have anybody young who will call in or text in and say somebody from Suits.
Are you watching Suits? Is it good or no?
Well, I watched it originally. So what happened was it was on for 5 or 6 seasons.
You're a Suits hipster. You were there first.
I was there first, John. Yeah. I knew them before they were popular. No, but it was pretty popular then. And then the show ended about 5 years ago. Netflix bought the brand and then they put it up there and it went crazy. So now a whole new group of people are watching it, including my daughter who's in high school.
My parents love it and I haven't gotten around to it yet.
Yeah, they're like every show. The first few seasons are fantastic. Then again, it trails a little bit.
Right. Okay, we got a lot of questions on the phone line. One quick one on the text line. Is there a statute that requires you to give fingerprints when you're arrested? Is that a pretty common practice when you're arrested?
Well, it's definitely a common practice. It's funny. I don't know if there's a statute that says that, but obviously that's police procedure, essentially. So I don't know if there's a statute that authorizes it, but it's done routinely and done with every arrest.
What if you were to say, I refuse? I don't know if you can.
Well, they would definitely get an order from the court saying you have to do it, just like you get an order from the court saying you're required to give DNA. You know, so they would just go to a court. They would get an order saying you're required to do it, and they would essentially force you to do it.
Doesn't mean that each state has it written somewhere in their laws. It just could be the common practice of police investigative procedures.
Correct. Although it might be statutory. I've never even thought about it. So that's why you stumped me, or the listener stumped me right away.
What a great question from the A47. Yeah. I love that. All right, let's go to the phone lines. Let's go to EJ. EJ, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm great. The answer to your question, first of all, it's got to be Tom Cruise, Lieutenant Daniel Caffey, and A Few Good Men.
That's nice. Right. That's a very good call. What's the line that you remember, though? I know you remember one line.
I don't. It's just the entire...
Come on, you're not going to give us...
It's Nicholson coming back at him with the line. You can't handle the truth. Okay. But what precipitated that, EJ?
Mike, why are you quizzing the listener?
I don't recall.
He says a question.
Because listeners are under cross-examination. They're subject to cross-examination.
Turn off your mic.
I want to know is I want to talk about in the E. Jean Carroll case, Alina Haba, the attorney.
Mm-hmm.
She caught a lot of abuse. Was it warranted?
You mean abuse from the judge when he was directing her about which questions she could?
I've never seen anything like that. I mean, everything she tried to do just seemed to... I mean, I don't have any dog in the fight. I don't care. But it just seemed like anything you saw on TV was very contentious.
All right,
I was wondering if that's normal or is it warranted?
Let's rewind a little bit just to set up what you're saying. I know what you're talking about, EJ, where she was essentially asking lines of questioning to the former president, and the judge was stepping in almost every single question saying, you can't ask that or you can't do that. So, Mike, rewind a little bit what you know about that case, Mike.
Yeah, there's a couple different issues that came up. One area that she was subject to criticism, it didn't even involve that issue, but prior to that, some of the basics that you have in trial practice, you know, some of the things we teach to lawyers who are in law school or people who are taking trial practice classes, you know, you can't just come into a courtroom and, you know, wave around documents or wave around evidence. You actually have to have the stuff admitted into evidence. So if I have a memo or an email or a picture or other item that I want to question a witness about, it has to be admitted into evidence. And there's a procedure that you go through to do that. So some of the criticism was just at her basic trial skills, that she didn't understand the rules of evidence. She didn't understand how to admit documents and other things of that nature. So that was, you know, pretty legitimate criticism, because, you know, that's kind of like trial practice 101. And it's something you struggle with sometimes as a young lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
You're trying to get an item into evidence, and you're struggling to lay the foundation. It's called lay the foundation to get it in. And the other side may be making objections because you're not doing it properly. And the judge is sustaining those objections, sometimes harshly,
mm-hmm.
sometimes in a manner that's trying to help you. Like, counsel, you know, you need to lay the foundation.
Just a quick reminder.
You need to do, you know, this, I can't do it for you. But some judges won't help you at all. They'll just like, hey, look, it's not my job to help you. If you can't lay the foundation to get this item admitted into evidence, mm-hmm. too bad. So sometimes it's tough to watch, you know, because, you know, you can see an attorney really struggle. So I think that level of criticism was absolutely warranted and appropriate, because obviously those are things you just have to know. And I think it stems from a lack of trial experience. Some of the other stuff that the public, I think, was more aware of was this whole thing where Trump was allowed to testify.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but again, just because a witness is allowed to testify doesn't mean that everything that they want to say and the lawyer wants to ask them is relevant or admissible, you
mm-hmm.
know? So in any case, you put a witness on the stand, it doesn't mean you're going to get to ask him anything you want. It has to be relevant to the case.
And that's not a violation of free speech.
No.
I saw a lot of people saying that.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's in the courtroom, there's no such thing as free speech. You know, we don't get to just say whatever we want or have the witness talk about whatever we want. It's got to be relevant to the issues in the case. So the Trump case was kind of a blatant example of that. They wanted him to be able to basically be put on the stand. And essentially, if they had it their way, he would have been able to just give like a monologue.
A campaign speech?
Like a monologue narrative, just talking about how the system sucks and how it's unfair. And of course, none of that's admissible and none of it's relevant to the case. So there were big battles about what areas of inquiry that attorney's going to be able to get into. And what they're not, because some of the stuff clearly has nothing to do with the question of determining damages in a defamation case, because that's what that case was about.
Only about damages.
Yeah,
that's all it was.
It has nothing to do with free speech. You know, we don't have free speech rights in a courtroom, okay? So that was appropriate. The judge basically said, look, yeah, we of course are going to allow him to testify, but just like any other witness in any other case, including that one, what he has to say and what you're going to ask him has to be relevant to this case.
Mm-hmm.
So if you think you're going to put him on the stand just to give a diatribe against me or the law clerk or the system, of course, we're not going to allow that.
So the judge can stop him from answering, but also can stop a lawyer even from a question like that question. Don't even answer that question.
Correct. Yeah. It's just like you see on TV. So number one, you know, the other side had filed what's called a motion in limine. LIMINE, John, if you're writing these things down.
I sure am.
Oh, yeah. And so basically trying to limit the testimony, which happens in every case, you know, in a lot of different ways. So some of these issues were talked about because of the motion, and it was clear, okay, the judge says, look, I'm going to allow him to testify. I'm going to allow you to get into certain areas. Certain areas are absolutely not relevant to this case. Don't ask about those. So just like any other trial, when you then try to ask the witness about something that has no relevance to the case, the judge can cut the attorney off after the question direct them. And that's not to be answered. That's not consistent with my ruling. Or the attorney can pose the question and the other side can object, like you see on TV.
Yeah.
And the judge can sustain the objection. So
you didn't see anything out of bounds by the judge?
No, there was nothing remarkable about it. I think what people were upset by who don't know what happens at a trial or why you can't just say whatever you want or ask about what you want is they didn't understand that, you know, they essentially wanted him to be sitting up there and just kind of giving a narrative or a speech, which you can't do in court, in any court. And there's nothing, he wasn't treated any differently than any other type of witness in any case.
And neither was the lawyer, you don't think?
No. I mean, here's the thing that's tough, okay? Every case, of course, has a different judge. Some judges treat the lawyers very nicely,
mm-hmm.
very respectfully. Hopefully no judges are listening to this show, but some judges could be sometimes accused of not doing that. Okay.
You're not saying that.
Yeah. Of course not me.
You've heard other people say that.
I've heard my brother say that. But sometimes the way that the judges treat lawyers sometimes is viewed by a listener as disrespectful. It might not really be disrespectful at all. It might be the tone that the judge takes. It might be that you've drawn their ire because you have not complied with their ruling. And so they're upset with you. They're humans too. So they're not all able to just simply keep an even-keeled demeanor, and that's not sometimes not their personality. So I think some people took umbrage with the fact that they thought the judge was too aggressive. You know, for good or for bad, you know, I've experienced a lot of that, you know, all sorts of different ways. We have a lot of fantastic judges, and sometimes you may get into it with them from time to time because you may have a disagreement about an issue, but obviously, you know, cooler heads should prevail, and they normally do.
EJ, that answer your question?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I have a follow-up, though. So obviously this is going to go to appeal.
Mm-hmm.
What's the process? How long does that take? I mean, the $83 million seem like a lot of money. How long? Like, what's the process and how long and how far up the chain can this go?
Before I answer that, I just want to say the $83 million, it is a big number.
It is a big number.
It's more than the lawyer asked for, which a jury is certainly allowed to do.
Yeah.
And I think what the jury probably struggled with is this is the second time this court has had to deal with this case. You've got to assess how much the defendant is worth because you are trying to assign some value that will ultimately, the goal is, make that person stop what they're doing. And I think that's why you have an $83 million verdict, because he's a billionaire, right?
Correct. Yeah. So it was relevant. You know, his financial capacity is relevant. Whether he did it multiple times is relevant. The fact that the timing of when he did it is all relevant. So, but EJ's question is kind of, what's the appeal process from here? So, number one, before there is even appeal, there'll be post-trial motions because they're in the federal district court. So they'll file post-trial motions, their attorney, and they'll say, you know, you should reverse the determination by the jury, or you should remit, you should reduce the award because it's not supported by the evidence or it's so outrageous, et cetera, et cetera. Post-trial motions, likely they'll probably be denied, although sometimes when you have a giant jury verdict, sometimes it does happen. It's called remittitor, where the district court reduces the damages, you know, based upon some reasoned basis. It probably won't happen here. It'll probably go up then to the federal appellate court for that circuit that covers New York. And then they'll argue on appeal, not just the damages, but to argue the decision in the first instance to rule in favor of the other side and against Trump on what was called summary judgment. We had a damages trial because the judge found that he lost the first part of the case. So they'll appeal the whole thing. It'll go up to I believe that's the Second Circuit that covers New York. And then theoretically, someone could then attempt to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. But those appeals to the U.S. Supreme Court are usually reserved for, you know, real interesting federal questions.
Other Trump questions.
Yeah. Not this case. Yeah. A typical case for defamation and damages, that's not a case the Supreme Court would normally take.
Right.
The Supreme Court doesn't have to take the case, and they probably wouldn't, because it doesn't present constitutional or legal issues that they would normally want to hear.
Okay. EJ, thanks for the call, my friend. Okay.
All right. Awesome.
Thanks,
Appreciate
EJ.
It. Thank you.
All right. Tell you what, let's, well, we got about 30 more seconds before we got a break in the news. So, Matthew, hang on the line. We will get to your question. Let me get to some of the answers from what is your favorite TV lawyer or a movie lawyer. And 847 chimed in with mine. Gregory Peck is Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird.
Solid. Very solid.
Solid. More than solid. That's awesome. Another vote from the 773 for the smarmy James Spader character from Boston Legal, the guy you love to hate.
He did a great job. I would agree.
A lot of Boston Legal ones coming in. 6-0 says the Michael J. Fox character.
Yeah.
331 says Jim Carrey from Liar Liar or Joe Pesci in My Cousin Vinny.
Joe Pesci, that's one I was trying to reach. Joe Pesci in My Cousin Vinny is one of the classic legal movies and performances of all time. And then when we come back, maybe we can talk about the actor who portrayed a defense lawyer in a movie that was supposed to be set in Chicago. So we can tease that, John.
Look at that.
I'm learning.
You are, but you still are yelling at the guests.
No, I'm just subject to the cross-examination, which is fair.
All right. We'll see about that. Oh, and really quickly, before we wrap up the EJ and Carol thing, because I don't want to talk about that anymore, I think it was Karen Conti who's coming up next at 3, who said that I believe he has to start making payments. Even if you appeal, the payments have to start coming in, and there's interest being charged thousands of dollars a day if he doesn't start making these payments.
Correct. So they could get an appeal bond, or they could get attempt to get a stay of the judgment. But absent that, then he would you know, the clock would be ticking. They could then do what's called citations or subpoenas to discover what his assets are, and then try to freeze them and try to take them. So yeah, absent some order from the court, either the district court or the appellate court, they can start collection proceedings.
Okay. 312-91-7200. We got lots more with Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney and a whistleblower lawyer as well. And 312-91-7200, let us know your favorite all-time movie or TV lawyer. We'll do more of that after the news, after this break on WGN. You never know what they're going to talk about on that show. Listen 2 to 6 afternoons. Then stay tuned for Your Money Matters. Sometimes I mix up the names of the shows I'm on, Mike Leonard.
Oh, boy.
Your Money Matters, Let's Get Legal. They kind of have the same syllabic, you know, flow to them.
This one's much more interesting, though, John. Come on.
Wow. Shots fired. 312-981. Well, I guess I'm hosting both, so I don't really care. This is Let's Get Legal. We're normally on Saturdays, and we moved to a Sunday because of basketball. Yesterday, we'll take you till 3 when Karen Conti takes over. So a lot of law here on this gorgeous Sunday afternoon. Got some great questions on the phone, like Mike. I want to dive right in. Matthew has a question about a case you worked on, right, Mike Leonard, involving Ken Courtright. Matthew, you're on WGN. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, a question from Mike Leonard. I read about the recent sentencing in the Ken Courtright case. I have two questions. The first is, I read and noticed that the government and the defense had fairly widely different ideas as to what an appropriate sentence would be. My question is this common? Why is that? And the second one is, how much of that time is he actually going to serve? How does that work at the federal level?
Great questions. Matthew, before he starts answering it, Mike, just recap that case for us for seconds.
Yeah, Matthew's referring to, there was a brief article in the Chicago Tribune about the sentencing hearing in that case. But Mr. Corto is accused of white-collar fraud, white-collar crime. The case went to trial, and he was unfortunately convicted. But then the issue was, what's the appropriate sentence? And as the Tribune reported in that case, you know, the federal prosecutors were looking for a sentence in the range of like 22 years. We were looking like one for a couple of years. And I thought the judge did a great job kind of getting to the core of what should happen and issued a sentence which was 7.5 years.
Is that chasm usually from cases? Is it a game, not a game, but is it a calculation you have to make to not appear like you want nothing? Like if you went to every judge and said, 1 year, come on, or supervision, you'd be laughed out of the courtroom. You got to be taken seriously, right?
Yeah. I mean, it just depends on the facts and circumstances of the case, and more importantly, at the sentencing, you know, kind of the life of your client, you know, his whole entire life and what he's done, and then, you know, what the offense was all about, and then, you know, what's there in terms of what's the purpose of sentencing, and what's a long sentence going to do. So, yeah, but very often you do have federal prosecutors looking for, in my view, outrageous amounts of time, and the defense counsel is looking for something very modest in comparison. The problem with these white-collar cases is that, and you know, this was a case involving wire fraud. So the problem becomes is that there's something called the federal sentencing guidelines that we've talked about on the show. And what they do is they take into two factors, essentially, the offense level and the criminal history. So in this case, the person had no criminal history. The offense level is just sort of a judgment as to the seriousness of the crime, and therefore it's assigned essentially a number, to put it simply.
So it's not like X amount of dollars. It's more of a vibe, vibe check, how big it was.
Well, here's the problem. So in wire fraud cases, you start with a level 7, but it goes up exponentially based upon the amount of money that's allegedly involved in the fraud. So you can have someone commit wire fraud, and the argument by the government is, oh, well, the loss was only $10,000, so you know it doesn't go up at all. But it goes up exponentially when you're talking about millions of dollars. And the question is really the length of the sentence, should that be determinative based upon the loss of money? I would argue no, because you can't just keep jacking up the years because the dollar figure goes up. You know, the conduct, in my view, is still similar. So that's what made the offense level go up so high, because of loss of money. And then the government argued, therefore, he should get a sentence of over 20 years, which I thought, in light of this gentleman's life history, which was great, and a lot of the other things he's done, and what's happened since he's been convicted, and all the purposes of sentencing, that over 20 years was an outrageous amount. The judge, a federal court judge, Judge Kennelly, I thought came up with a very reasoned and reasonable decision, which was 7.5 years. And you got to take in all sorts of things into account. But you make a good point, you know, from a credibility standpoint, an argument standpoint,
yeah.
can you go into court every time and regardless of the case,
yeah.
argue for a year? No, you can't. And also in federal court, sometimes you have what are known as mandatory minimums.
Ah.
So it can't be below a certain number. But yeah, you have to look at, you have to be able to make arguments that relate to that defendant and his life or her life. And then also, what are the purposes of sentencing, right? And then I think Matthew's second question was, okay, if you get one of these sentences in federal court, how do we figure out how much time a defendant's actually going to serve? And a rough calculation is you take the number of months, multiply that by 0.85, because you typically will start with the idea you're going to serve 85% of your sentence.
Which is a lot more than in a state court.
Correct. Well, it depends. Yeah, sometimes in state it's only 50 or less. So, you know, you take that 85% of whatever number you get, and you're already down a significant amount.
6.37.
And there you go. And then also, you know, the way things have gone the last few years, there have been a lot of changes within the Bureau of Prisons and our view and the court's view and the Sentencing Commission's view of what's an appropriate length of time to be incarcerated. So now people, as they're serving their sentences, are much more eligible to get what's called good time credit. So you can have that expectation. You can get maybe a couple more years knocked off. So, you know, it's going to be 85% to start with, and then you're hopeful that you're going to get some time off that, maybe a year or two. And then also, typically in federal court, you're going to get released within the last year or 6 months or so, and sometimes have to go to a halfway house. So what you're going to serve is going to be significantly less, you hope, than what the number appears on its face.
All right. Matthew, thanks for the questions. We appreciate it, okay?
Thank you.
I got to argue with something, Mike. You don't think that the sentence should go up higher based on how much money is taken in a wire fraud and a white-collar case?
No, I see the argument that, yeah, of course, a $10,000 fraud is more serious than a million, or is less serious than a million-dollar fraud. However, you can't keep upping the offense level just based upon the dollars. That's where I think it doesn't make sense. So if you get to $2 million or $5 million, $10 million, to say that someone should be incarcerated for 10, 20, 30 years, no, it doesn't make any sense, because you have goals that you're trying to fulfill with sentencing, and a lot of times when you do that and you have these outrageously long sentences, it doesn't fulfill any purpose after a certain amount of years.
I guess I know what you're saying. It's like when you get robbed on the criminal side, if you rob a bank, you're going to jail for the act of robbing the bank, not that you got away with a million versus 1,000.
Correct. But
the
Yeah, but I do understand in a white-collar case, yeah, there is a strong argument that obviously, based upon the loss amount, some cases should be treated more seriously than others, and therefore someone might be eligible for more time. But when you start getting the stratosphere above 7 years, above 10 years, above 15 years, 20 years, you're not serving any purpose. You're incarcerating them. They're not a danger to society. You're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars per year. They're not going to be released and therefore be able to make restitution to the victim. So there's a lot of things that go into that. It just doesn't make sense after a certain amount of years. You're not fulfilling
right.
any purpose of sentencing.
It's not like someone committing wire fraud has the sentencing guidelines next to them and go, well, I'm not going to do these next $10 million. Because that would up me a little bit.
Correct.
It's not a deterrence.
Yeah.
Although, I don't know, $92 million. Although, I wanted to say one other thing, and we're going to get to Tom, I promise. He's got a great question. In that answer, you kept on saying the word alleged. After a case has been decided, do you still feel that, and maybe you truly believe this, but is that a tough line to thread? And like when you got to argue in sentencing, the jury's already found you guilty that you did this. Do you still say alleged? Like,
no,
does that language?
No, you don't continue to contest the facts, right? But you'd be surprised, even at the sentencing stage, there's a lot of arguments about how to properly calculate
yeah.
that what's called loss amount. So even in this case, there's big arguments about, you know, literally 20 to 40 or more million-dollar swings in what is the appropriate way to calculate how much money was actually lost. So that's often times a very big debate. But yeah, no, you're not at sentencing. You're not contesting the facts. However, you are mindful that if you're on appeal, what your client may say to court might have some bearing upon, you know, your stance on the appeal and what they can say. But no, you're not trying to still argue to the court, we think we're innocent, because the court doesn't want to hear that. The court wants to hear what are the legal arguments for sentencing and for this person, and what's the appropriate sentence for this person.
Interesting. Okay, we're going to take a break on Let's Get Legal, powered by the Illinois State Bar Association. Keep texting in. Ooh, here's a good favorite lawyer on all-time TV after Sam Waterston announced he's not going to be on Law & Order anymore. Lionel Hutz from The Simpsons.
Wow.
That's a good one.
Okay, when are we going to discuss Richard Gere as a candidate?
Oh, Primal Fear, right?
Primal Fear. We got to cover that when we come back.
We got to take a break, and then Tom's got a great question. Tom himself has pled guilty to a white-collar crime, and he's looking for an answer from you, Mike Leonard. It was a case a long time ago. It should be interesting. We'll get to it next on WGN. Mike Leonard, federal defense attorney. It feels like, I don't know, March, April out there, Mike?
Feels good.
We'll take it.
Plus the sun. Just the sun alone, John, makes it a good day.
By the way, you can reach Mike at 312-380-6559. I got that right, right?
You do.
312-380-6559 is how you can reach Mike Leonard. He's a federal defense attorney. Also handles whistleblower cases as well. Were you practicing 34 years ago, Mike, or no?
Not quite. I've been practicing about 31.
31. So Tom could not have used you.
I was in law school. I could have consulted. I could have done the legal research for
Tom.
Well,
let's get Tom on the line. Thanks for holding, my friend. How are you today?
Good afternoon, gentlemen, and the Honorable Mr. Leonard. My name's Tom. In 1986, I pled guilty to federal, not paying federal taxes. I'm state, of course, also. And was sentenced by the honorable, and may I say beautiful, Judge Susan Getzendanner.
Okay.
I remember Judge Getzendanner.
She resigned out from the federal bench just as you started and went to work for Tom Ed. So.
Yeah, I actually
I don't know.
She's got a son, a great guy, worked with him for a little while. But, yeah, she predated my time in federal court. But, yeah, well-known judge.
Okay. So, Tom, so this was 1986, and your question is what?
My question is, I pled guilty. I was sentenced to 4 years probation.
That's nice.
I had to fulfill the complete time and pay a $5,000 fine and pay the taxes.
Okay.
It probably didn't feel this way to you, but that was that viewed as a pretty good result at the time?
No, it wasn't. I got it was better than hard time, yes.
Right. Yeah. You didn't go to jail.
What was your attorney pitching the court for in terms of a sentence?
My attorney didn't pitch.
Oh.
We'll bypass that question.
You guys can talk afterwards about the... I'm trying to get to this question, Tom. Go ahead, my friend.
Yeah, okay. The question is, I'm wondering, since it's been... I finished serving my probation in 1990, so it's been almost 34 years, and I've been clean since then, no problem. And, of course, I've lost my FOID card, so I can't own a firearm, and I don't own a firearm. But I'm living in an area that's changing nowadays, and I'd like to own a shotgun or something. I'm 76 years old. So
you want a gun. It's your legal constitutional right as Americans to have one.
Yes.
Except felons can't.
Correct. Felons can't. So what would be the possibility of getting a case, I can't think of the proper
expunged.
Term.
Expunged.
Expunged.
Yeah.
Correct.
So, Tom, you can't get a federal felony expunged. That case is so old. I'm surprised there's not some way within the FOID process that you can raise that argument that the conduct is more than 30 years ago.
And nonviolent.
Which is a huge factor. There was a nonviolent case. I don't have any experience on... challenging FOID determinations, but I got to believe there's an argument to be made there. But you can't get the federal felony expunged as a general matter, but there's got to be a way you can work through the FOID process through the state to make those arguments. But unfortunately, I'm not the one to make them because I don't really fully know what I'm talking about, Tom, but I'm just kind of speaking it out loud here.
So, Tom, have you done any research on like an appeals process? Is there anything like
that?
No,
I haven't. I just applied once for the FOID and the Illinois State refused it. So
yeah. Then how long ago was that?
That was about a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Did they give you? Was there an appeal rights? Were there appeal rights on there or no?
You know what? I didn't check at that time, but I was just wondering if I could get the case.
Yeah. You can't. You can't get a sponge. You should take a look at what your appeal rights are, and maybe you have to reinstitute it by applying and getting denied and then appealing. I don't know, but that seems like there's got to be a process. I'm sure. Though an automatic disqualifier is, of course, the felony conviction, as we know. But I would look carefully what it says about your appeal rights on the document that you got.
Yeah, Tom, it's a great question. And sorry you went all through that, but everything's been fine since 86 and 90 when you got all done with that?
It sure has.
Good.
Great.
See? System worked. Thanks, Tom.
Like I say, the only thing is even though at the time of sentencing, you could have served 2 years, and if I paid the fine, they were letting a lot of people off the remaining 50% of the sentence.
Yeah.
And no, they maybe served a full four, even though I paid the fine off in 2 years.
Yeah, 4 years is pretty brutal. Typically in federal court, you can sometimes go in. It's more of a probation supervised release situation, but sometimes you can go in and get your supervised release time cut at least, but not the sentence itself. So right. Sorry to hear you had to do the 4 years, but sounds like it, I wouldn't say worked out well, but worked out probably as good as it could.
It was probably best that I did 4 years.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
All right. Good talking to you, Tom.
So he did 4 years of what? It wasn't prison.
Probation, which is fantastic. It means he didn't serve any day.
So what happens in probation? Why is that bad? Who cares at that point?
Well, because, I mean, really, when it comes down to probation, it's just simply that he had to not commit another crime. He was under the eye, so to speak, of U.S. probation, meaning they could check on him periodically. But really, essentially, it meant that he couldn't violate the law, federal, state, or local. And as long as you're a law-abiding citizen, it doesn't seem too onerous to many. But having that watchful eye over you for 4 years, worrying about if you screw up, could I go back to court? Could they then impose a sentence upon me? Could they impose a sentence just for the violation? So you just don't want to have that scrutiny for that time.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you there. And it was interesting. Right at the end, he said, it was probably good I had 4 years.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe he needed those 4 years
that
to
might
straighten
be for
out.
Tom might have to call in for another episode. We'll have to see.
217 says, I like Tom. I do, too.
Yeah, seems like a good guy.
Yeah, for sure. Do you want to talk about food or lawyer? Because we got a couple calls.
Right. Let's go with the calls.
Favorite TV or movie lawyer of all time? Let's get Lori on the line. Hey, Lori, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great. Good to talk to you again, Lori.
I have a tie for the best TV lawyer.
Okay. All right. Who do you got?
Jackie Childs, Kramer's lawyer on Seinfeld.
Yes.
Ah, okay.
That's a good one. Uh-huh.
And Bob Blah Blah on Arrested Development.
Yes, Bob Blah Blah. And he had a law blog, the Bob Blah Blah Law Blog. One of my favorite TV jokes of all time. Lori, those are two good ones. Nice work.
Lori, what did you think of the performance of Richard Gere in the movie Primal Fear? Did you ever see that one?
I did. It was so long ago, I don't remember.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty solid. I think it deserves a top 10 nod. You know, yeah. Plus, it was set in Chicago. It was set in Chicago. They would meet at a bar on Lincoln Avenue. So I think, you know, we got to consider that.
Lori, I'm sorry Mike cross-examined you. You didn't deserve that. It's fine. But I appreciate the phone call. Thanks, Lori.
No problem.
All right.
Thank you. Go
to Ron. Ron, who's your favorite lawyer, movie or TV?
Well, I think movie, The Rainmakers.
Oh, I don't know the Rainmakers.
With Matthew McConaughey? He's like the young lawyer. Is that the one or no?
No.
Matt Damon, Danny DeVito.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Right. I like that one. Yeah, that's what I meant. Matt Damon's the young lawyer, right? And he comes in and he's working kind of under Danny DeVito's tutelage and they're battling in the insurance company, that one?
Yeah, and John Voight is the guy he's going against.
Oh, that's
yeah.
Right.
And then Mickey Rourke company. Is like the real sleazy boss of Matt Damon, right?
Yeah, there you go.
That was a great one. I think that's a great one.
Ron, good call. We appreciate it. 312-991-7200. A lot of texts coming in as well. What about Saul and Better Call Saul?
Oh, I love Saul. I would put Saul at number one. I love Saul. Fantastic.
Someone wanted to know, this is a good question, a legal question. How do you know if your lawyer is stringing you along? What an interesting thing. Because, lawyers have a lot of quote-unquote delay tactics, but a lot of them are probably very legitimate. There's processes that courts have to go through and judges. But how do you know if your lawyer is just lying to you?
Well, I mean, you could look at the case docket, right? So every case, whether it's a civil case or a criminal case, there's called a docket report. So you can look up the case. You can see the activity that's taken place. You can see, hey, status hearing held on such and such date or motion filed on such and such date. So you can get a pretty good idea of what's occurring in the case. And it is frustrating to clients, both in criminal cases and civil cases, that the so-called process often takes a long time. You know, a status hearing, then another status hearing for 60 days, and then, you know, the state or the feds have more discovery to give you another status hearing. So It does. It does take a quite a bit of time, typically, and you know that, you know, based upon whether the case is in federal court or state court, you kind of have a good thumbnail timeline of how long it should take. But I don't have an answer for whether you're being strung along, but you can kind of check up on things by looking at the court docket and get a better understanding of what's been taking place in your case. That would be my probably best advice.
You know, I had never knew that there was a legal malpractice law side of things, too.
Oh,
Gary
sure.
Grasso, who is the mayor of Burr Ridge, who's been on this station and show many times over the years, often outspoken about a lot of issues and a great voice to have on the programs, he does that, and he's come on the show to talk about that even lawyers do you wrong sometimes, and you need a defense for that.
Yeah, you can have a civil case based upon your lawyer's action. So the simple ones are, hey, you know, I went to a lawyer, I gave him the facts, he was supposed to file a lawsuit within the statute of limitations, within mm-hmm. the 2 years or whatever, didn't file the case, so therefore the case got dismissed because it wasn't filed on time. There's a lot of nuance to malpractice cases. You can argue that your lawyer didn't do a good job, but
right.
you know it's not something that's just judgment or opinion. The lawyer's typically going to win that
because
they're given a wide range of leeway to make professional decisions. But yeah, that happens as well.
I left you 2 minutes. You've been begging to talk about food. Does it relate to the Super Bowl, Mike?
Should have talked at the beginning. Yeah, I'm going to give you
why at the beginning? I'm going to 2 minutes here.
Food should always start. You know, we should always start with food, John.
You are not the producer of this program. That is Iridian Fierro.
I'm a mere guest, but here's my top three.
Okay.
I'm always going to go with the Taco 12-pack. I'm going to go with the 7-layer dip from Jewel. I mean, does anyone ever eat 7-layer dip if it's not the Super Bowl? I don't think so, John. I don't think it's even there. And number three, I'm going to go with a giant sandwich, maybe from Bari or somewhere, just a giant sub you can cut into pieces.
So tacos, a sandwich, and taco dip, essentially.
And then probably four, I'd probably move on to pizza maybe at half.
Okay.
And then I need a sturdy chip that can hold up to like a French onion dip or
like
something
scooper,
like that.
Maybe, yeah, something like that.
Yeah. What about you? Quickly, what do you got?
Shrimp dip. My great.
That's so un-Super Bowl like, John.
What are you talking about?
Shrimp dip?
Yeah, it's really good.
I think people should respond to that on a text line because I don't think you're going to get a lot of support.
Cream cheese, shrimp, and a can of cream of shrimp.
But you're talking about Super Bowl food. I don't know. I hope the text line can respond to that one. I think you lost a little credit. I think you lost
occasion.
A little bit of credibility on them. But go ahead.
Wings.
Wings, sure. Solid.
Big boneless wings.
Yeah. Love the boneless wings. Yes.
I don't like eating the bones.
No, I agree with you.
Pack animal.
Yeah. Especially at a party.
Yeah. And pizza's always a stalwart. But I what I like about any great party, it's grazing. I know we're not supposed to do this. Dawn Jackson Blattner, our great dietetic nutritionist, says never graze. But pick out your favorites. Go small bites. I don't like a sandwich or a bit. I don't want to make it feel like a meal. It should feel like a 4 hour long.
All in.
Graze.
And the only thing that the show that was on before us, he was talking about veggies. No veggies allowed at my Super Bowl party, John. None.
How dare
None.
You disparage
Sorry.
Richards
no veggies
in this great
allowed.
Program. That'll do it for you. Someone just texted in. Who is this? I'm John Hanson. That's Mike Leonard, 312-380-6559, federal defense attorney and whistleblower. It's good to talk to you, my friend.
Supposed to be a legal show. Thanks, John.
Time for the news on WGN.